This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. That's the classic opening chords of These Eyes by the Guess Who. It was their breakout hit, number one on the charts, and a perfect showcase for the complex arrangements and incredibly versatile voice of frontman Burton Cummings.
These eyes cry every night for you. These arms long to hold you again. The hurting's on me, yeah, and I will never be free. No, my baby, no, no.
It was 1969. And for a while, the Guess Who were as big as it gets. And if you're Canadian, they're even bigger. The first huge Canadian rock and roll act, paving the way for border-crossing superstars from Arcade Fire to Justin Bieber and Nickelback. It was a long road from rec hall rehearsals in Winnipeg to the top of the world, though even at 13, the precocious Cummings got a taste of glory when he wasn't in homeroom.
Bands, when they reach a certain level of fame, everything changes. I know when I was in my first band, I was 13, 14, 15, 16, still living at home. We were treated like the Beatles, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night. It was like a whole other world. Then Monday morning, back to high school and back to normal, back to earth. When you, at that level, it's wonderful. It's all music. It's not business yet. It's not pressure yet.
It's fun.
It's not peer pressure. It's just pure fun for the sake of the music. Then I got into the Guess Who. I wasn't quite 18 yet. The Guess Who was already huge in Canada. They had had Shaken All Over, and they had toured with the Turtles and Dion DiMucci, and they had toured with Chuck Jackson and Maxine Brown and all these famous people, to be the Kingsmen doing Louie Louie, and they had toured with all these people. And they phoned me, and I was still 17, and they asked me to join the band.
You grew up with your mother,
My mother and her parents. Mother and grandmother.
Your mother and grandmother.
My dad was a useless drunk who beat the hell out of my mother when I was about 10 months old. It was a bitterly cold night in Canada, Christmas time, about 30 below. She grabbed me, blood all over her, ran down the street a half a block to where my grandparents lived and got me out of that hell.
And you remember that?
Well, seriously, I do. I wasn't even a year old yet, and I remember when the police came, my mother was covered in blood, and my grandmother and grandfather were freaking out. And I remember it was Christmas time, and I was crying like crazy, and the policeman gave me a tiny little candy cane. And they say you can't remember stuff past 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah.
That's not true. I remember it very, very clearly.
Right.
He gave me a little candy cane to stop me crying, and I never saw my dad again till I was about 23, and I only saw him once, and he was a pathetic drunk.
Even 23 years later, he was...
Oh, pathetic.
Damaged.
He came back. Alec, I had a wall full of gold records. He came back when I was 23 and asked me, "Can I get you something? Do you need a pair of pants?" That's, you know, what Mark Twain
he
said.
He didn't know any better.
Mark Twain said once, the difference between fiction and fact is that fiction has to make more sense. You know, that's, for me, that night was like playing a really bad part in a soap opera. It was awful.
Yeah, but when you're a child and you're growing up with your mom, you're musical from the get-go, I mean, from when you're a little kid?
Bless my mom's heart. She started me on lessons when I was 5. And so by the time I was 8 or 9...
You playing the sax then? What'd you play?
No, I played piano. I was a pianist from day one. I took classical lessons. You know, at one time I could play Rachmaninoff, Beethoven. Whatever you put in front of me, I could sight read it the way you and I can read words. Can't do that anymore.
No, really.
I used to be able to, but I can't do it anymore. But the funny thing was I had a wonderful piano teacher, but when I started falling into Jerry Lee Lewis and Fats Domino and Little Richard, I wanted to be a pounder, you know. And she was so against that, man. She wanted to straight ahead Beethoven and Rachmaninoff and, you know, Fur Elise and all the wonderful classics. There's nothing wrong with that. But, man, I wanted to I wanted to rock a bit, you know. She was against that.
You did play the sax after
that. I played sax, yes. I learned how to play sax.
To get into a band? Why did you pick up the sax?
I bought a sax for $20 from a guy in West Kildonan in Winnipeg, and I figured out the fingering, and I listened to Johnny and the Hurricanes and the Rebels and some of the other saxophone groups and figured it out myself. Now, here's a weird thing. I didn't know. Nobody ever bothered to tell me that the fingering was the same on a flute. So years later, we're doing this record called She's Come Undone, which got a lot of airplay, and there's a little flute solo in the middle.
Well, I love that song, Undone.
That's me on flute.
No.
And the funny thing was, I had been playing sax for a few years already, and we were opening a Yamaha store in Winnipeg, and they were selling flutes, and there was a flute in the glass case. So Randy Bachman, the famous Randy Bachman, taking care of business, you ain't seen nothing yet, BTO, my partner.
BTO.
At that time, he and I were together in
the
Guess
Who. He went on to form BTO after the Guess Who.
Yeah, but he and I wrote These Eyes and all those things together. So we're sitting waiting to do our show at this Yamaha store, and there's a flute in the glass case. And we love this group called Traffic. They had a flute player named Chris Wood, and we love Jethro Tull. I mean, flute was coming into rock and roll. So Randy says, look, man, you love Traffic and Jethro Tull. There's a flute right there. Why don't you learn how to play it? And I said, but I don't know the fingering. The Yamaha guy says, well, the fingering's the same as a sax. I said, you're kidding me. I grabbed it. As soon as I got the aperture right and could make a note with my lips, I played it on stage that night.
Oh, my goodness. You had an instinct as a musician. You just had an instinct.
So. Bachman bought me a little book about chords, and he said, you damn well learn how to play rhythm guitar. And about 3 weeks later, I was playing rhythm guitar.
You're like MacGyver. You're like the MacGyver of music. You're getting it all done.
No. I like all instruments. I would love to be able to play a trumpet or a horn, but I just don't have the lips for that. But when I love Chet Baker and stuff like that. You know?
When you're 17 years old, now granted, you're mostly in Canada, performing in Canada, and you guys don't break out into the U.S. until you're how old?
69, I was 20. These Eyes, when These Eyes came out, I was 20. So that was a monstrous record.
And when you're in the band and you're 17 years old, the first thing they ask you to do is what? Play keyboards and woodwinds and everything?
I joined basically as the piano player and a background singer because they still had Chad Allen in the band.
And he was the front man.
Yeah, and he sang Shaken All Over, which was a pretty big hit record.
And when he left, why did he leave?
He went back to university. He didn't trust show business, you know? And I had my teachers tell me the same. Can you believe it, Alec? My high school principal told me, show business isn't a profession.
Right.
Can you believe
that? Well, they did have a point.
But that's a dinosauric type. I said to him, you know what my response was? I said to him, well, tell that to Frank Sinatra or Elvis Presley or Paul McCartney.
Right.
That show business isn't a profession.
No, but
that's
ridiculous. But you also have the great pleasure of music is something that you can enjoy completely on your own. Burton Cumming is considered a keyboard at home and get real pleasure and real joy from himself out of playing music.
Music can be very self-fulfilling, and it's very, very cathartic sometimes. If I'm stressed or something.
Sure. Now, when you're 17 and they call you and you come in and do that, then he leaves to go back to university. Are you the front man then? They come to
Suddenly,
you?
Suddenly, I'm singing everything.
Were you a singer prior to that?
Well,
you were in a choir as a boy?
Yes, as a matter of fact. I was in the Anglican church choir for 3-4 years. My real training, if you could call it training, my vocal training came in high school. I did the tenor lead in HMS Pinafore, and the following year was Trial by Jury. And as you would know as an actor, these are huge, huge undertakings. It's not just a bit of singing. It's, you know, I am poor in the essence of happiness, rich only in never-ending unrest. In me, there meet a combination of antithetical elements at eternal war with one another,
it's
ridden
light
hither
opera.
By objective influences. You know, Gilbert and Sullivan, man, there was pages and pages of dialogue. Then you'd break into a song. So I did all that at 15 and 16. Mm. That's pretty good training.
So they knew you could sing when you came on board.
Oh, I think so.
Guess who?
And the Devrons, before I was in the Guess Who, the Devrons, we were kind of breathing down their neck. You know, but we were the young guys in town in Winnipeg. So there was an echelon, and we had worked our way up to probably be in the second or third best next to them. They were so much better than anybody else.
Now, can you? No, I don't want to treat you like some kind of a jukebox here, but can you play for us? It just so happens we have a keyboard.
Hey, look at this! A beautiful Yamaha keyboard.
That thing in front of you is a Yamaha. Now, can you play for us? What's a song you would play when you were with? What was the name of the group?
The Devrons.
The Devron. What were the Devrons playing?
Oh well, we did all kinds of stuff. I would try and do things that other singers weren't singing. In other words, I would try and do something like this. They asked me how I knew my true love was true. One's reply, something here inside cannot be denied. Stuff like that where not
great.
Everybody has the chops to get those notes,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Or things like, those Walker Brothers records. Remember the Walker Brothers? If you really love him, and there's nothing I can do, don't try to spare my feeling, just tell me that we're through. And I was trying to do the more complex songs and ballads, and everybody else was just doing, I got a gal named Boney Maroney. I was trying to make our band a little bit different, and I noticed that we were getting more female attention
from these
big ballads, man. Because
right.
Not everybody
love
can
songs.
Do. I mean, you saw Elvis fans at
sure.
the end. They would go, they'd lose their
and
mind.
And I read what you wrote about love songs when they re-recorded American Woman.
Mm-hmm.
Those ballads are what live on forever.
Well, the funny thing was These Eyes. I mean, that's goodness gracious. Can you imagine being a 20-year-old white boy from Winnipeg, Canada, from the prairies, and you have this monstrous record called These Eyes in 1969. Radio is still segregated at this point. Very, very segregated. What happens? Junior Walker and the All-Stars, one of the biggest acts on Motown, record These Eyes, and they have their own hit version of it the same year as ours. Randy Bachman and I were flabbergasted. This is a hero of mine. He had Shotgun and Shake and Finger Pop and Cleo's Mood, and he had a million hit records of What Does It Take to Win Your Love for Me? This was Junior
Walker. He recorded your song.
He did These Eyes, and his went top 10 in Billboard the same year as ours because his got played in urban areas where our white bread version didn't necessarily move in.
Right. So when you're with the first band,
mm-hmm.
The Devrons,
yes.
Are you songwriting then? Are you a songwriter then? Did that come easily to you?
I tried and tried and tried from the time I was 14 or 15. I tried to be a songwriter. I was so enamored with... First of all, before the Beatles and the British Invasion, there were wonderful writers, you know, Jerry Goff and Carole King, Pomus and Schumann, Lieber and Stoller, Burt Bacharach and Hal David, all these incredible songwriting teams. And I was such a fan of the writers. Then when I got a little older, I was more of a fan of the writers that sang their own stuff. And then Bob Dylan came along,
right.
And he was writing all his own incredible
Simon and
lyrics.
Garfunkel,
and
yeah.
Paul Simon, yeah.
Beatles.
And then, you know, Paul and John. I mean, forget it,
yeah.
Man.
You're downgrading yourself as a writer. When you get into the Guess Who and these huge monster songs of yours, these beautiful songs, did you write them with
Randy?
With
yeah.
Randy?
Yeah, Randy and I, we wrote These Eyes in about 28 minutes. It wasn't even...
So you got more skillful at writing songs.
And I think we were good for each other,
right.
Because he was a guitarist, I was a pianist, so the yin and yang bounced off each other. I would show him a piano riff sometimes, he would show me a guitar riff sometimes, and we did a song called No Time, which was a pretty big record. And
I know that one, too.
I love that one because, I'll tell you why, Alec.
You sang No Time.
Oh, yeah. And
I mean,
it.
Your voice is all over the
On
place.
On my way to better things, I found myself some wings. It was a good record, and Randy had this great riff. He was playing, and he started singing, No Time Left For You. And I sang over him like a round. On my way to... You can't do both at once. No time left for... On my way to... No time left for...
Yeah.
So I sang over him like a round, and he liked the way that sounded. And I worked on the lyrics for a while, but there was no piano on that record. See, that's a guitar song. And that's when we started getting taken a little more seriously as a band. That's when Rolling Stone finally gave us a nod and said, well, maybe they're not... The Ohio Express, so maybe they're not, you know.
The Ohio Express. You got great references. So when you sit down and you do These Eyes, there's obviously the opening notes of that on the keyboard. And does the songwriting begin there?
Well, here's
how does the song begin?
Interesting thing about These Eyes. I'm the piano player, but that piano riff was Randy's. And I always thought I was so impressed that a guitar player could come up with... those are very clever chords for a guitar player to
right.
be playing on piano.
Right.
And but he wanted to call it These Arms, you know. So we worked on it, and I had that energetic part in the middle,
yeah,
that,
yeah.
That energy, that was all mine. These eyes have seen a lot of love, but they're never gonna see another one like I had with you. And kept taking it up a whole tone.
These eyes.
By the time it got up, where?
Yeah. So you're seven. So you're 17 years old, and where are you playing when you're with the guests? The guests who is playing where predominantly in those early days?
Early days, a lot around Winnipeg. We would sometimes go as far east as Kenora, 130 miles into the province of Ontario. We flew in 1967. We went to England. It was February. I just turned 19, and the whole thing fell apart when we got to England. Now, the great part was we were in swinging London in the 60s.
Sure.
1967 in London. Are you kidding?
Oh,
I was
beautiful.
In the Bag of Nails one night in Soho, and I'm playing a slot machine. I'm having a brown ale. There's a guy next to me with pretty long hair. I didn't really look up, and I'm playing a little more. Finally, after about 10 minutes, I turn. I look. It's Bill Wyman from the Stones. And he's just in a pub, Alec, in a pub, having a drink, playing
taking
the
a break.
Slots.
Yeah.
He did a little film with The Who in some club.
Ooh.
And that was the real British invasion days. And I was only 19, and I was taking it all in.
You were loving it. When you come back, the scope of the Guess Who broadens.
We came back in 67, beaten and ashamed. And I was ashamed to leave the house for a week because everything had fallen apart. We plodded on through that summer of 67. We were just about ready to break up as a band. And along comes CBC Television, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
Sure.
They offer us a weekly half-hour show for 36 weeks.
No.
Yeah. And that saved us. We got out of debt, paid for our lovely silk suits, which we were still trying to pay off, paid for our lovely amps, our new guitars.
You did 36 half-hour shows?
Mm-hmm.
So that's 18 hours of shows. What do you play for 18 hours?
Oh, every week we did what was ever on the charts. We weren't writing a lot of our own stuff
yet. Oh, I see. You're doing covers.
So we would do Van Morrison. When we went to New York for a trip, we'd come back and we'd do songs by the Everly Brothers because we had seen them in New York. We'd do Van Morrison because we saw him. Whatever was on the charts, we had to learn about 12 new songs every week. You know, we at one point, Alec, we were doing 4 one-hour shows a night, and I was doing all the singing. We do 60 minutes on.
What was your
on,
secret?
10 minutes off. My secret was I was 18, 19.
And you have a very durable voice.
I still smoked cigarettes. I drank beer. I did a lot of the wrong things for a singer.
You sang those songs and you smoked cigarettes?
Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. I sang all the time.
Right.
So it's like running or high jumping or pole vaulting. If you're doing it all the time.
You're always in tune.
Yeah.
So what year do you go to the next spot where you're in the U.S. market and you're going to start.
Interesting story. So we did the television for 1 year.
Right.
Okay. We got great chops from that because we had to read some music.
Some nice
and
clothes.
Learn all the different. We were doing things from the Fifth Dimension to Van Morrison.
What did you do from the Fifth Dimension?
Oh, Up, Up and Away. Paper cup. Last night I didn't get to sleep at all. And
no.
They had some great, great records, man. So,
yeah.
Sweet Blindness and
I love
Parade Down to a Stone Cold Picnic. So I will tell you this. We did the TV show for 1 year. They wanted us back the second year. We said, absolutely. This is steady money, no traveling, right? We're in our hometown. Second season starts. The producer, bless his heart, he said, I know you and Randy are writing some songs together. You've got a national audience here, captive audience, every Thursday at 5:30 for half an hour. Why don't you do a couple of your original songs on the show? As irony would have it, as Cinderella stories are written this way, one of the ones we chose to do was These Eyes. Our producer, Jack Richardson, who lived in Toronto, whom we had not really met yet, happened to be watching the show that day and heard the song and believed so much in the song, Alec, he mortgaged his house to fly us to New York and record our first album for RCA. And after These Eyes, everything changed.
When you first performed in the U.S., where did you go? I mean, in a big venue.
Well, we started off in New York at the Felt Forum. Well, we weren't able to sell out the entire Madison Square Garden, but there's a great place called the Felt Forum where the Doors played there.
Sure.
And the Kiss at the beginning and everything. So we started at the Felt Forum. As things got bigger for us, we started playing some of those big festivals. And I'll tell you, that people ask me sometimes, what's one of your greatest memories of the career you've had? I'll be 70 this year, so I've got a lot to remember.
Sure.
The Seattle Pop Festival, Alec. May of 69.
Wow.
We got to play all three nights.
Wow.
It was 80,000 people. Now, at that time, that was a lot of people.
Sure.
We only had These Eyes yet. On the strength of one hit record, we got to play all 3 days. Listen to this. The Byrds, the Burrito Brothers, Bo Diddley, Ike and Tina Turner, Frank Zappa and the Mothers, the Jefferson Airplane. It's a Beautiful Day, the Youngbloods. And the last night, Led Zeppelin and the Doors.
Wow.
Both on stage, back to back.
Oh, my God. So you go there on the strength of one song, as you say. What are some of the songs?
The other songs?
Well, right. I mean, so what are name a couple of the other songs that weren't these big hits? Because you have a lot of songs that I remember that are beautiful songs. No Time and Undone. And
we had a huge record called Clap for the Wolfman, which was a bit of a novelty, but we had been on Midnight Special so much. I got to be very good friends with Wolfman Jack.
Sure.
He was a fascinating guy. We stayed up late a few nights, drank beers till toasting the sun coming up. And I couldn't get enough of hanging with him because he knew everybody. He knew all my heroes. Personally, he knew Duane Eddy and Bobby Darin and all these people that, you know, the early days of rock and roll. So his stories were endless. And after being friends with him for a while, I came up with these lyrics, Clap for the Wolfman. It went top five in Billboard. It was kind of a novelty little thing, but
sure.
We didn't see it coming.
Right.
We didn't see American Woman coming.
Right.
We didn't see it coming. Number one in Billboard for 3 weeks? Whew. I never would have even imagined.
No, like every band in their early days of success, they get robbed. They make deals with people. Did you get rich off these songs? You
no,
didn't.
No, we lost a lot of money to bad business managers, and the producer and his company had all the publishing on the first few songs. So we didn't really. When I left the Guess Who, I didn't have that much. I really didn't.
When did you move to LA full time?
1976, I moved here, and I did my very first album. I got to, my manager, Lauren Schaefer, got me hooked up with Richard Perry, a fantastic producer who did Carly Simon and the Pointer Sisters and God knows how many big hit records he did. So he did my first album. He did Stand Tall, and I'm Scared was another song on there, and that was fantastic working with him.
Now, along the way, did you get married? Do you have any kids? Do you have a family?
I'm married. I got married in 81, I guess it was. Yeah, we're still married. No kids. My wife's a homeopathic doctor. We're far too busy. The dogs are enough to look after. We have two dogs. We've always had two dogs through the years. And we're both far too busy. And you know, some people, they have kids before they realize they don't want them.
Right.
And then it's too late.
Right.
We talked about this ages ago.
And you were clear.
People say, don't you want to have a kid? What about your legacy? You know what?
Songs of your kids.
Doesn't keep me awake at night.
Sometimes late at night, when there's nothing here except my old piano, I'd almost give my hands to make you see my way.
Burton Cummings' rock and roll didn't dominate popular music in the 1960s. It was still a huge appetite for easy jazz and big orchestras. And Herb Alpert satisfied it. In 1966, his Tijuana Brass outsold the Beatles.
We had a command performance for the Queen of England. We played there, and the band sounded...
Tijuana Brass?
Yeah. Band sounded great. And then meet Prince Charles, who said, "Oh, I have all your records in the den."
Herb Alpert's stories from his 60 years of making music on heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
Eyes to see, too many across the sun. She's come undone.
Burton Cummings, main songwriting collaborator, in the early years of the Guess Who was Randy Bachman, the band's guitarist. Their collaboration changed the sound of the late 60s, but their differences in temperament ended up pulling the band apart. Today, the men have reconciled. Here's Bachman alongside Cummings as they're inducted together into the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Grateful to meet this guy who was born to be wild when I was born to be mild, and together we put something out that was kind of magical. I'm really thrilled at that.
But it took a long time to get back there.
We fell out. Randy turned Mormon in 66.
Now, where is he from originally?
He's from Winnipeg,
right,
as well.
And how did that happen?
We were playing in Mormon. Regina. We spent the whole summer of 66 in Regina. How about this? Seven guys in two hotel rooms. Four in one room, three in another.
Wow.
We played every single night that summer. We'd drive to some tiny town, play for 100 people, pack up our stuff, drive back to that same hotel the whole summer. That was my introduction to the luxury of the road.
Yeah, yeah.
2 months of absolute hell, but it toughened us up and it toughened my voice up. But Randy married a Mormon girl in 66, and everything changed between him and me and between him and the rest of the band. First of all, now he wouldn't ever have a Coca-Cola again or a cup of coffee, nothing with caffeine. He would not want us to have a cigarette within 50 feet of the bus. You couldn't have alcohol. You couldn't do this. You couldn't do that. You can't do this. You can't do that. And Randy just turned into a scoutmaster.
Right.
And that's not cool in rock and
roll
band.
Was he kind of the opposite of that before that? Was he
he
wasn't a wild man.
No, he wasn't a wild man. He'd have a vodka and orange juice with you and maybe smoke a pipe. But suddenly, he was this taskmaster, and it just got ridiculous. You know, we were still writing songs, but the joy and the love was gone out of it. And then he tried to convert the rest of the guys in the band and wanted us to come to the temple with him. You know, hey man, I'm the easiest guy in the world to get along with, but you're not going to convert me to some new religion, you know, because you are. And as close as Randy and I had been. It was over at that point. He just got completely immersed in the Mormon thing.
From that point on, how long do you stay together before you break up?
Oh, it was still another 3 years.
Oh.
I mean, he met her in 66. The whole thing kind of festered over 67, 68.
So while you're making it,
mm-hmm.
while you guys are really busting out.
He's a Mormon.
He's with her.
Mm-hmm.
You split up with Randy what year?
70.
Who replaces him?
Kurt Winter and Greg Leskew, the two best guitarists in our hometown back in Winnipeg. And I immediately, thanking the music gods, I immediately had a new writing partner in Kurt.
And you have success with him as a writing partner.
Oh, yeah.
What songs did you write with him?
Well, I wrote Share the Land by myself, but with him. Kurt wrote Hand Me Down World. He came into the band and Hand Me Down World followed up American Woman.
Right.
And those words are still pretty good today. Anybody here see the sky weeping tears for the ocean? Man, that's 47 years ago, and that's still pretty powerful.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Anybody here see the noise, see the fear and commotion?
I think we missed it.
Anybody here see the sky weeping tears for the ocean?
You sang that.
Yeah. Kurt had these great, so he had another song called Bus Rider, which was on our Share the Land album. Kurt and I wrote a song called Albert Flasher not long after that. Kurt and I wrote a song called Heartbroken Bopper. We had another one that went top 20 called Rain Dance. Don't you want to rain dance with me? Don't you want to rain dance? That was a great song. Fifi said to Don the baker, can you show me how to bake another bun, Don? And I'm still sitting with my next door neighbor saying, where'd you get the gun, John? Don't you want to rain dance with me? So we had a bunch of records that did very, very well. Another one called Star Baby. And we kept getting asked back on Midnight Special. So that's how I knew we were doing okay, because that was a live show. You had to play live on there.
But Share the Land, you wrote together.
Share
with
the
them.
Land, I wrote myself.
You wrote that,
that was
yourself.
A big, big record for me. And
how does a song like that begin?
They still call it one of the anthems of the hippie era.
But how does a song like that begin?
Have you been around? Have you done your share of coming down? Different things that people do. Nice way to start it, but you gotta have that hook, you know? So it was, there was the hook. Maybe I'll be there to shake your hand. Maybe I'll be there to share the land they'll be giving away when we all live together. I'm talking about together now. Yeah. That one came quick.
Yeah.
About 20 minutes, half an hour.
Now you're kidding me.
No.
You're kidding me.
I don't, see, I'm not one of these Carole King guys, and don't misconstrue that. I think she's a genius. I love Carole King's work, but there's these writers, you know, they get together at 12 noon and, oh, it's only 10 to 12. Is it time to be brilliant yet? Oh, we'll get together and we'll write on Saturday at 6 p.m.
Right.
I've never been one of those guys.
It comes flying out of
you. If it's not happening, I will not sit and try and force it. On the other hand, at 3:30 in the morning, if I wake up and I got an, I'll run to the piano and record it and write down lyrics and stuff. So I've never been one of those guys that forces it.
Oh my God.
And I've done over 30 albums by not forcing it.
Who were some people that you worked with, like whether you played with them, opened for them, they opened for you eventually, it doesn't matter. Who did you dig? Who did you like? Zeppelin? Did you like British Invasion?
Anybody that's my age that has any music in them, the Beatles blew everybody away. Right. I mean, it's almost silly to talk about the Beatles in the same breath as anyone else. They were that far above everyone else. I really do think
that. Well, they transformed themselves so much.
Yeah. And you, think of this, Alec. They weren't even together. Together for 7 years.
Yeah,
the
barely.
Beatles. They changed the entire world. The length of your hair and my hair today has something to do with the Beatles.
Yeah.
The Beatles came along, then the Stones, the Kinks, the Zombies, Manfred Mann, Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas, Eric Burdon and the Animals. Are you kidding me?
Did you and Randy write Undone?
He wrote that.
He wrote.
I changed a bit of it, but I mean, basically, it was really his, and I didn't want to put my name under
it. That's a cool song.
Those are very nice chords.
She's come undone. She didn't know what she was headed for. And when I found what she was headed for, it was too late.
It's a good song.
No time for a summer friend. No time for the love you send. Seasons change and so did I. You need not wonder.
When you guys really, really shot that up, you need not wonder
at the
why.
End, I was going, God, all the time. Like screaming up in the clouds.
When you guys would ramp it up, were you the only one singing, or did you guys get
They all sang background, so we all jumped in, and I would do the lead vocal, and then I would join them to reinforce the background vocals as well. Because at that point, things had just changed from 8-track to 16-track. This is what I'm talking historically now. And it was all of a sudden, there was a big change. You had 16 tracks instead of 8. So you could spread more over the drums to have better drum sound. You could double your vocals with the... Now you can have 100 tracks. I mean, now it's all different.
Yeah. And a lot of auto, too.
Yeah. We used to drive 500 miles to Minneapolis to record in 4 tracks.
Right. Now, when you go solo. And what was that like for you? Did you miss being in a band?
Terrifying.
It was.
I've talked to Neil Young about this, too. When he left the Buffalo Springfield and went solo on his first few solo albums. And Neil's from Winnipeg, too. Right. We all grew up at the same time. Me and Bachman and Neil Young. And we all used to play the same little coffee houses.
Wow.
So there was some kind of energy in Winnipeg, Alec.
Yeah.
Something was going on there. Because it's just a dot in the middle.
We had Gordon Lightfoot on this show.
Oh, well, he's, you know.
Man. We love him.
Oh, he's, if Gordon Lightfoot's favorite singer were Rod Stewart.
Wake up, Maggie, I think I got something to say to you. Or find myself a rock and roll bun. Oh, Maggie, I wish I'd never seen your face.
Now, did you do much acting? Because you're such a performer.
I did one film. I actually got to work with Paul Sorvino. We did a film called Melanie. Glynis O'Connor starred in it.
Where'd you shoot it?
We did the interiors in Toronto and the exteriors here because it was supposed to take place in L.A. And I did a racquetball scene with Paul Sorvino, which is, you know, I brag about that a lot. In the film, it's about 2 minutes. It took 4 days.
But you didn't want to go on and do more of it?
I...
Why?
I couldn't.
You're a natural. The voices you do.
The sitting around.
You couldn't take the sitting around.
Honest to God. You act for 3 minutes. Yeah. You act for 3 minutes, you play cards and eat for seven hours.
In a 12-hour day, you act for about 45 minutes.
I mean, honest to God, I it drove me nuts. I've got OCD and I'm very energetic and it made me nuts.
Yeah.
I can go on stage and keep you interested for 2 hours as long as I have this, you know.
But
I'm not an actor.
So when you say you went solo and it was terrifying,
because you're used to the cocoon of a band,
sure.
You know, and then suddenly you're a solo guy and it's hired guns tour by tour. It's not really your band anymore. You're hiring guys just for that tour.
Sure.
So the emotional connection is never quite as strong, and then you don't see them anymore.
Right.
But when you're in a real band, you're going to see guys all the time.
Yeah.
But, you know, you hire them by the tour. It's different, man. It's really
different. Did things change? You wanted to be in a band again?
I've had the same band now since Millennium Night, 2000, 1999, 2000.
You have a band now?
Yes. We just call ourselves the Burton Cummings Band.
But that's perfect.
But I've had the same guys for 15 years. So it's the best of both worlds.
Are you still writing?
Oh, absolutely.
You are.
I had a new album. A new album. It was 2008, 2009.
Right.
And it was a double album. It was 19 songs. I wrote everything on it myself.
Right.
I'm still. And I have a poetry book that has just come out. Actually, I brought one for you.
Right.
A book of poems, 52 poems that I've worked on over the last 9 years. It's serious poetry. It's about all different things, and I've always loved poetry. I wrote it in school. I was always encouraged, the writing, you know. So I'm a creative guy. I stay up late at night. I Google. I read endlessly.
Yeah.
I'm building a magnificent music library. I have 375,000 songs in my hard drive now. It's 2.4 years of music continuously.
Oh, my God.
All with proper artwork. It's a Smithsonian.
Oh, my God.
And,
now,
and
did you ever want to stop? Have you ever said to yourself,
retire,
I want to stop?
Mean?
No, not even retire. Just walk away from it. And like, I don't want to say palate cleanser, but something like that, where you just kind of purge yourself and reset. Never did that.
I did it once. My manager was Shep Gordon for years. And when he first got his place on Maui, he was still here in Bel Air all the time. Summer of 77, he said, why don't you go over and stay in the house for a while? So I stayed for 8 weeks.
Yeah,
and it's beachfront in Maui. That place has been on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Sure.
It's remarkable. I had a maid cooking for me, making me fresh tabbouleh in the morning. I'd go out in the front yard and pick a mango off the tree and then go down to the water for a while. And, you know,
you got used to it.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful.
So so briefly you walked away from it.
Yeah, for that one summer. But honest to God, I'm an OCD guy with a lot of energy.
Sure.
I don't like to be too idle.
Right.
You know?
When you perform live now, and when you go in front of an audience now, how does it feel? Does it feel the same in general? Is it always the same?
You know, there's a lot of times, Alec, I will be on stage. It'll be a Saturday night. It'll be about 9 o'clock. And it'll take me right back 50-something years to the same feeling I had in the North
End. It's 9 o'clock on a Saturday.
Oh, there you go. You know, it's honest to God, I get that same feeling that I did when I was 14, you know, 55 years ago.
So when you perform, you still get excited.
Oh, absolutely. And nervous, too.
Really?
Honest to God, my hands still sweat. My heart rate goes up. You see me about 2 minutes before I go on stage, my hands are dripping with sweat, and I'm always worried, have I got the chops? Have I got the vocal chops tonight? Am I going to hit the notes? I've talked to pretty big people about this. Tina Turner, Rod Stewart, they still get nervous.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you really care, you get nervous.
Yeah, well, you're gonna
if
wonder.
You don't care, then you don't give a shit.
Well, I mean, we used to always say, we'd walk out and go, we'd wonder, is this the night? And someone said to me, what do you mean? I go, is this the night they find out that I don't really haven't got it? Is this the night they find out the truth about it?
That's the same. Basically, you're paraphrasing what I just said exactly.
Yeah.
Is this, am I going to have the chops? You know,
now, what have you done for your voice to maintain? I mean, obviously, you're someone whose your voice is like this clarion sound.
I think, you know, honestly, very simply.
If I do adjust the key.
I quit smoking. I finally quit tobacco.
Right.
About 5 or 6 years ago.
Not that long ago?
No, I smoked for 50 years, over 50 years. But you know what's funny? All my favorite singers were smokers. Think of a guy like Roy Orbison. Sang like a bird, you know? Sang like a bird all the time. Chain smoker.
Good God.
Never would have thought
Sinatra.
Of it. When I was in the Devrons, we got to open for Roy Orbison. This is about 1964, 65 in Winnipeg. I wasn't even in the Guess Who yet. We got to open for Roy Orbison. And, of course, I stayed later, and I wanted to talk to him after the show. Alec, he's sitting talking to me with red Marlboros, one of the strongest cigarettes,
yeah.
cigarettes there is, lighting one off the other.
Yeah.
Chain smoking one off. This is the guy that's saying, crying over
only the
you.
Lonely. Oh. But you, but did you have to adjust the key you sing in some of the songs, correct?
You know what? We do everything down one half step. That's not bad for
no.
40 years.
Right, yeah.
We're still doing most of the songs just a half step down. And that wasn't even me so much as my band. They like to do things a half step down because they have their own singer. They do a lot of gigs when I'm not around.
Right.
They have their own singer, and he does a lot of Beatles and Zeppelin and stuff way up high, and he needs that extra half step down. And I must admit, you know, songs like Stand Tall and These Eyes, they're a little tougher to do now,
sure.
40-plus years later. But that half step allows me to, I'd rather do the songs a little bit
lower. How does Stand Tall sound half step down?
Oh, goodness, let me see. Well.
Sometimes late at night, never been this blue. Never knew the meaning of a heartache. But then again, I never lost a love before.
You're waiting for me to go way up there.
No, no.
Stand tall, don't you fall. For God's sake, don't go do something foolish. All you're feeling right now, silly human pride.
Well, wow. That's... No, 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 no. Hey, man.
I'll tell you something a lot easier is like this.
Okay.
Clap for the wolf man. He gon' rate your record high. See, that's a lot easier.
You sing two notes, and people go, I know who that
wow.
is. I know that song, you know. If you sing, you know, sometimes late at night, you
wow.
sing that song, and people go, I know who that is. You know, they know your whole thing.
Wow.
And you are a great great musician, and you are a great singer.
I'm very humbled by this, and it was my pleasure to be here and see you, really and truly.
Yeah.
I didn't know that you knew all the songs and stuff, but it was... Lonely feeling deep inside. Find a corner where I can hide. No sugar tonight in my coffee. No sugar tonight in my tea. No sugar to stand beside me. No sugar to run with me. No!
Burton Cummings. I still had more questions, so I called him up to hear how life on the road feels when you've been doing it for 40 years and when everyone wants to hear the same four hits.
You know, the thing is, I've been asked a million times through the decades, don't you get tired of singing the same songs over and over? Maybe some people do, but I certainly don't. And here's the thing, don't people remember how hard it is to get a hit record in the first place?
Right, right.
I mean, the odds are stacked against you, no matter who you are, as far as getting a hit record. So why would I even think twice about not wanting to perform them for the rest of my life? I'm thrilled to get out there and sing the songs that everybody knows.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, like you said, that's a very good point, how hard you worked to get a hit in the first
place.
Well,
I mean, the thing is that the odds are stacked against you, and that was back then when a lot of people had hit records. There are a lot less people today having to have a hit single today. it's like jumping through hoops. It's almost impossible.
Yeah. Well, it's also like classical music, anything good, anything great, like, Beethoven's Fifth, it doesn't matter. You're not going to listen to it every day, but you can come back and hear it again and appreciate what it
Absolutely.
Has to offer, whether it's beautiful
Absolutely.
Pop music or rock music or what have you. Now, the other question I have is I looked at your book of poetry that you gave me, which was very nice. I appreciate that. But the question that I have is that how do you distinguish what's poetry and what's lyrics?
Well, that's a very good question, too. They are completely two separate universes. When I'm writing a song, I'm already thinking of melodies to go along with whatever the lyrics might be. Whereas with poetry, it just has to stand by itself. It doesn't have the backing of a band with drums and guitars and melodies and, you know, the same shading that... Poetry just has to stand as words on paper.
Right.
So when I'm writing poetry, it's a completely different thing. I'm hearing it as I write the poems. I'm hearing them in my own head. And that's the way when someone reads a poem, they're hearing it in their own voice, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with songs, it's a completely different situation.
The lyrics have to marry to the tune. You've got to put two things together.
It's more than just words on paper. Whereas with the poetry, the words have to be very strong. They have to convey some kind of a message that makes the reader think something.
And you find with poetry, you can do whatever you want.
It's a different world. You know, songwriting and poetry, two different worlds completely. I like both. I wouldn't say I prefer one over the other, but I've probably had more experience writing songs because I've done over 30 albums and written most of the stuff myself.
Have you ever thought about singing your poems?
They don't lend themselves to vocals.
No time for a summer friend. No time for the love you send. Seasons change and so did I. You need not wonder why. You need not wonder why. There's no time left for you.
He'll always be known as Guess Who frontman Burton Cummings, but don't overlook his poetry. That book he gave me sold out. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's The Thing Comes from WNYC Studios.